Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with sanctions imposed today by the U.S. government against Russia for the use of a nerve agent in an assassination attempt against a Russian exile in the U.K., which led to the death of a British citizen, Dawn Sturges. David Kotz, a professor of economics at the University of Amherst, Massachusetts, and the Shanghai University of Finance and Economics, who was the co-author of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia, joins us. We will discuss how additional sanctions are not likely to influence Putin's behavior, no more than the sanctions already in effect have, and that the recent history of the use of sanctions as a tool of foreign policy indicate they are largely a palliative to make the domestic audience feel like something is being done as a punishment, even though the evidence indicates they do not hurt bad actors. In fact, they often lead to the further enrichment of dictators, as was the case with Saddam Hussein, and in the case of Fidel Castro, they served as an excuse for shortages and deprivations which were and are being blamed on Yankee imperialism, not Communist Party central planning. Then, with the Manafort trial underway revealing exorbitant corruption and Trump's former campaign manager's shadowy ties to kleptocrats and oligarchs, we will speak with Diana Pilipenko, the Associate Director for Anti-Corruption and Illicit Finance at the Center for American Progress, who previously managed corporate investigations and analysis at the Big Four accounting firm of Deloitte. She joins us to discuss the growing similarity between the kleptocracy Putin oversees in Russia and our current government, as we learn today that the first congressman to support Trump was charged with insider trading, and from Forbes magazine that Trump's Secretary of Commerce stole $230 million from a business partner and quietly settled the matter before joining the Trump administration. Then finally, we'll speak with an expert on Turkey, Max Hoffman, Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, who joins us to discuss the collision course that has U.S.-Turkey relations heading for a showdown with two autocratic leaders, Trump and Erdogan, butting heads and unlikely to back down. We'll examine why there has been little effort by the Trump administration to free three Turkish nationals who worked for the State Department, but because of Vice President Pence's ties to the evangelical community, the release of an imprisoned American fundamentalist pastor has become a top priority. And joining us now is David Kotz, who's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the Shanghai University of Finance and Economics. He's the co-author with Fred Weir of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. And his latest book is The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism. And he has a chapter in a new book, Economic Crisis and Industrial Policies. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Kotz.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
And today, the State Department announced that the U.S. was sanctioning Russia over the nerve gas poisoning, the nerve agent poisoning with the use of Novichok. In the U.K., the statement from the State Department is as follows. The United States determined under the Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act of 1991 that the government of the Russian Federation had used chemical or biological weapons in violation of international law or has used lethal chemical or biological weapons against its own nationals, State Department spokesman Heather Nauert said today. So this sort of flies against the narrative that Putin owns Trump and Trump is his sort of poodle or his puppet. How do you see it?
Well, it doesn't seem to me that Trump is under the control of Putin. It's clear that Trump admires Putin and his regime. I think he views Putin as a role model, a successful authoritarian ruler, which Trump aspires to be. But you don't have to view Putin as a good guy to think that there is a problem with this sanctions approach. This approach has a number of problems and negative results, in my view.
Well, I think, essentially, sanctions, we've had them forever against Saddam Hussein, for example, and that just made him and his family richer. I could cite a whole bunch of examples. And the theory that I've heard from a lot of political scientists is that essentially the reason we sanction people is we can't do anything else, and it's a sort of palliative to our own domestic audience that we're doing something.
Well, I think there's two problems. One, there's the premise, and two, there's the consequences. The premise of these sanctions is that Russia is a rogue state that commits all these atrocious acts for which the United States should punish it. Well, Russia does seem to have done some atrocious acts, but every single one of them is an act that the United States has done at one time or another in the not-too-distant past, assassinating opponents of the United States, military intervention in ways that are devastating for the place where the intervention occurs, violating the sovereignty of other countries. I mean, all of these things are practices of the American government, so it's hypocritical for the United States to view the Putin regime as a rogue state. It's a big state that does unsavory things to pursue its perceived interests. Saudi Arabia obviously does similar things. Israel does similar things, and they're close allies of the U.S. So there's a problem with the premise. Secondly, there's a problem with the consequences. There's no evidence that sanctions will lead to a state bowing to the U.S. demands. So I agree with your characterization of the consequences and why they do it, that it's don't know what else to do, and they want to punish Russia. But really, the U.S. should pursue good relations with Russia. Russia has it's a major power in the world. It has a lot of nuclear weapons. If we're to avoid accidental or other nuclear war, it's important that the U.S. be talking to Russia, be trying to make progress on nuclear arms reduction, arms control, etc.
Well, you're just reading from the Trump hymnal there, David.
Well, no, Trump says that Putin's a good guy. You know, I don't say Putin's a good guy.
Right.
When Trump says we should have normal relations with Russia, I think that's right. And it's not just Trump who says that. There is a good, solid, progressive view that comes to the same conclusion, but for different reasons. I think the reason Trump has this policy is that he admires Putin.
Right.
Whereas I don't admire Putin, but think it's not a sensible policy to treat Russia as an enemy.
And again, I'm speaking with David Kotz, who's a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the Shanghai University of Finance and Economics. He's the co-author with Fred Weir of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. And his latest book is The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism. And he has a chapter in a new book, Economic Crisis and Industrial Policies. So when you said, though, that the U.S. does the same things, and you listed accurately stuff that the U.S. has done, but I don't remember the U.S. using a weapon of mass destruction except for Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which, of course, are pretty significant exceptions. But that was a long time ago.
I'll say, and the super powerful bunker buster bombs, some of the weapons the U.S. has used, the mines, the enriched uranium weapons. There are definitely questions about U.S. compliance, unfortunately, with international law and a number of areas of weapons use.
So have we ever used weapons of mass destruction against our perceived political enemies in foreign countries? Just to follow through on why the U.S. is sanctioning Russia today because of the use of Novichok against...
Well, I don't quite see the connection. There's two issues. One is the use of banned weapons. The other is the illegal assassination of individuals who are viewed as enemies of a regime. Those are two separate issues, to my thinking. And, Russia brought in both of them. If it was indeed behind the attempted killing in Britain, But the United States has, you know, there's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there's the other weapons I mentioned, and then there's a long list of assassinations that the United States has carried out over the years. The attempted assassination of Fidel Castro, which was admitted. So I don't see a big difference there. I don't see any difference, actually.
Well, you're going back to World War II and the Cold War. So are we in a situation where decades later the guilt still haunts us, or are we part of an effort to have some kind of rule of law in the current global community? In other words...
Well, I wish there were an effort to bring rule of law, but I don't see it. Where was rule of law when the United States participated in an invasion of Libya to overthrow its ruler? That was a violation of international law. The invasion of Iraq, etc. This goes on. There's not a new Cold War. The Cold War was different. The Cold War was between two different socioeconomic systems, that of state socialism in the Soviet Union and its allies, and then capitalism in the Western countries and Japan, etc. NATO was an instrument to carry out that Cold War from the capitalist side against the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union disintegrated and communist parties fell from power throughout Europe in 1989 to 91, there was no longer any rationale for NATO. And instead, NATO was turned from an anti-communist alliance into an anti-Russian alliance to a significant extent, that has focused on inserting itself into all of the countries around Russia. It really is an encirclement of Russia that they're aiming for. I mean, imagine how we would feel if some powerful foreign country created an alliance that included Mexico and Canada, a powerful military alliance that was hostile to the U.S. They wouldn't feel too comfortable.
Clearly, that is the case. But how do we deal with this reality? We have in Russia today a kleptocracy, and there's a very good book by the Yale historian Timothy Snyder about the current situation, The Road to Unfreedom. And what I'm concerned about, and you're absolutely right, that, you know, Gorbachev and George Bush Sr. may have come to an understanding, which the U.S. reneged on and moved eastward into the former Soviet states. And that has created paranoia. There's no question about it. And what military value there was, I don't know. But there is a certain value to these countries having democratic freedoms and the rule of law. You don't have that in Russia. And where, because of Trump's fascination or affection or whatever it is, this connection with Putin, you could make the case that we're heading into the kind of kleptocracy that Russia has become under Putin. You know, you've got Wilbur Ross. We learned from Forbes magazine that he just stole $230 million from a partner and had to quietly settle. And today you have the charges of insider trading brought against a New York congressman, Republican, who was the first congressman to support Donald Trump. So that's my greatest concern, that it's not that Trump is the Manchurian candidate controlled by Putin, but that his affection, as you call it, for Putin could lead to the undermining of law in this country, which is clearly what Mueller is looking into.
Yeah, I think that's what he's aiming for. I mean, there's an irony here. In the 1930s, leftists in the U.S. used to say, if you look at the Soviet Union, you'll see America's future. Well, I have this uneasy feeling that right now, if we look at the oligarchic regime in Russia, we might see America's future. And, you know, I think the conclusion is that we, that is, you know, those popular forces that exist in the United States, need to oppose this direction in the U.S. I think Trump will ultimately probably not succeed in his vision for America. And in Russia, it's really up to the Russian people to get rid of the oligarchic regime there and bring about one that will respond to the needs of ordinary people. But I don't think that can be done from the outside. And in international relations, because of the aggressive U.S. policy toward Russia in many parts of the world, Putin, despite being a very unlikable character domestically, has actually taken some reasonable positions in some international trouble spots, such as in Syria. I think Russia's position has been pretty reasonable. And I think it's possible for the U.S. government to work with the Russian government while the American and Russian people struggle to change their governments.
Well, I think I agree with everything you said, except, of course, for Putin's support of the murderous Assad regime. We should turn our attention to the situation we have in this country, and Russia under Putin should be the model that we should be trying to avoid, and that all goes, it all leads to November the 6th of this year when we get to vote. And just in closing, though, I am concerned that since Putin meddled in the last elections, that he will meddle in the 2018 elections.
Well, he might. I mean, of all the charges against Russia, I think the one that is most serious at this time is the election meddling. Although, as everyone knows, our government has meddled in foreign elections many times. It's an unacceptable practice when the U.S. does it to others, and it's an unacceptable practice when others do it to the U.S. We have to try to prevent this. Our election should be determined by the American, our election outcome should be determined by the American people, not by foreign interference.
Well, thank you for joining us, David Kotz.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Kotz, who is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the Shanghai University of Finance and Economics. He is the co-author with Fred Weir of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. And his latest book is The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism, and he has a chapter in a new book, Economic Crisis and Industrial Policies. We can take a brief station break and back looking into the growing similarity between the kleptocracy Putin oversees in Russia and our current government.
That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you sold. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, getting low. Motion is perpetual. We call drill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say by slow. Dudes, don't let them play us. Girls, they are.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Diana Pilipenko, who is the Associate Director for Anti-Corruption and Illicit Finance at the Center for American Progress, who previously managed corporate investigations and analysis at Deloitte, a Big Four accounting firm, specializing in anti-corruption, anti-money laundering, sanctions, and export control compliance. She led numerous investigations and assessments on behalf of commercial, federal, and nonprofit organizations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diana Pilipenko.
Thank you so much for having me.
And obviously, all eyes are glued on the Manafort trial, where his deputy, Rick Gates, has turned state's evidence against him. And, of course, Manafort's defense are trying to blame everything on Gates. I don't think that's working, is it? Do you?
I don't think so. Gates has made some very compelling allegations and testimonies. And what's more, the prosecution has also presented plenty of documented evidence, be they emails or certain corporate records that bolster their arguments and their allegations. So, for instance, when they discuss bank fraud or misrepresenting income or classifying income as loans in order to not have to pay taxes or hiding foreign bank accounts, they've also presented documents that sort of back up those statements.
But the broader picture surely is how much money Manafort made out of his work to get Yanukovych elected in Ukraine. The estimates that have been published in conjunction with this trial say he was paid $60 million. I spoke recently with Anders Asland, who worked in Ukraine at the time and knew Manafort when he was working for Yanukovych. He said that Manafort was actually paid $9 million a year for 10 years, so that's $90 million. Do you have any idea of exactly how much he was paid?
The figure that I've seen is $60 million as well, but I think, and perhaps it was more, but I think what's really important is only a fraction was officially reported. So much of the income that he's derived from his consulting work in Ukraine has been, funneled through secret accounts in Cyprus, and which indicates that perhaps some of it was ill-gotten or illicit, or simply that was the means of circumventing certain regulations and taxes. So I think the contrast between what was officially reported and what he made in actuality is very significant.
But in effect, wasn't Manafort really being paid by Putin? I mean, Manafort's right-hand man, Konstantin Kalimnik, apparently is a GRU officer, and it's inconceivable that Manafort would have been controlling Russian media for Yanukovych, which is what he did, without the Kremlin being involved and sanctioning it.
I think the trial and other evidence that has come to the fore has, in some ways, is consistent with pro-Russian interests and who was actually paying Manafort for his work there. We know that, for instance, he was initially introduced to the Ukrainians, to Rinat Akhmetov, the Russian oligarch who was backing the Party of Regions in Ukraine. He was introduced to them by Oleg Deripaska, a Russian oligarch and somebody who's deemed fairly close to the Kremlin. And so there is a certain confluence or alliance that's forged. And of course, the Party of Regions is very much had a pro-Kremlin platform. In fact, when Yanukovych fled, he fled to Russia. So I think that is certainly out there, and this is why these relationships, even though they may be, in some cases peripheral, are still central to the questions regarding collusion and what may have transpired during the 2016 presidential campaign here in the United States.
And again, excuse me. And again, I'm speaking with Diana Pilipenko, who is the Associate Director for Anti-Corruption and Illicit Finance at the Center for American Progress, who previously managed corporate investigations and analysis at Deloitte, a Big Four accounting firm specializing in anti-corruption, anti-money laundering, sanctions, and export control compliance. She led numerous investigations and assessments on behalf of commercial, federal, and nonprofit organizations. And Diana, you just used the word oligarch. The judge in the Manafort trial has forbidden the prosecution for using that word. Well, you're from Ukraine. Ukraine has been basically run by oligarchs, and that's been their struggle, has it not, to get out of the away from the Russian Putin model of kleptocracy into a more democratic model with the rule of law.
Absolutely. Ukraine has been plagued by corruption since independence, and it's been very difficult to shake it. And Manafort, too, when he was brought on board, he was paid by the oligarchs backing the interests of the party. And so this model whereby the interests of the government and the interests of business are completely sort of blurred and converge is one that has, has engendered some of these issues of corruption. And the term oligarch, I think, because of the sort of the way the post-Soviet assets and were privatized, it's gained sort of a bad connotation. And I think that's why Judge Ellis has asked that the term not be used, because I think right now it's not just business tycoons, but ones that have, allegedly engaged in corruption and gaining their wealth. And so that's a very sort of packed and fraught term, and especially in the context that we use it, often oligarchs are deemed close to the state, of, be it the state of Ukraine or the state of Russia.
So Oleg Deripaska, I think he loaned about $30 million. Actually, he gave Manafort $30 million to invest through offshore Caribbean tax avoidance vehicles. And I think something like at least $10 million of that money disappeared. And we know from this trial that Manafort was absolutely frantically trying to inflate his worth and get bank loans, and forged a bunch of documents to get bank loans because he was trying to pay off Deripaska. And then the minute that Manafort took the job, even though he was broke, he took the job for no money to be Trump's campaign manager. Suddenly it appears that all was forgiven with Deripaska, and then he offered Deripaska private briefings, and they changed the platform of the Republican Party to be much more Russia-friendly. Then the minute that Manafort was no longer, when he was fired by Jared Kushner, suddenly Deripaska comes back into the picture and sues him. So I guess my first question would be, you wouldn't want to owe Deripaska money, right? He was kept out of the United States because it's alleged that he killed about 42 people in the so-called aluminum wars when he took over the aluminum monopoly in Russia.
Deripaska has a very, as far as Russian oligarchs go, he has a very fearsome reputation. And I would say, yes, you do not want to owe him $19 million, which I believe is what has been reported that Manafort owed him after he failed to make investments on his behalf. And yes, there were sort of two periods to Manafort. Initially, he was making a lot of money in Ukraine, millions of dollars. But then after the Yanukovych party lost power and Yanukovych fled, the sources of income for Manafort dried up. And, you know, on top of that, he was in debt to Deripaska and perhaps others. And yes, it seems an alternative means of sort of financing that debt proved to be access that he offered. And of course, there have been plenty of reporting specifically on his offers of private briefings to Deripaska. And Deripaska is seen to be fairly close to the Kremlin. He was recently sanctioned, he as well as his companies. And so this sort of a quid pro quo, if you will, is very troubling and has been very closely scrutinized. And perhaps there will be more information that will come to the fore as to the specific arrangement that was floated.
Well, but if you use the sort of gangster analogy, and I think that's fair because Russia today is a gangster state with the godfather of the godfathers in charge. He regulates the oligarchs. They're allowed to loot the country, but then they have to do what he tells them to do. Otherwise, like Khodorkovsky, they'll lose their billions and be lucky to flee into exile. So that's the system. So isn't it logical that there is a Kremlin connection throughout this, that, in other words, you get Manafort hooked on money, you know he's greedy, you loan him money, he's terrified, and then he ends up being the campaign manager of the person who you most want to influence in the world, the possible president of the United States. And we won't go into the details about how much speculation there is about exactly how much influence Putin has over Trump, but it was pretty evident from the press conference after the Helsinki meeting that they'd conducted in secret with no record. A lot of suspicions about that have arisen. So what do you think about that as a logical scenario, that the hand of the Kremlin seems to be behind this 100%, and that's probably why Mueller is interested in Manafort and trying to squeeze him?
Yes, Manafort is an apt operative. He's had these long-standing connections to Eastern Europe, which, you know, could have been very much exploited during the campaign. And I think it's effective to pair Manafort and sort of his connections and potential ways in which he was compromised with Russia's overall effort to interfere in the election. It wasn't just Manafort. It wasn't just the June 9th meeting, which Manafort attended. If you recall, the Russian government attorney who came allegedly offering dirt on their political opponent. But it was also the hacking of the DNC servers. It was also the broad sprawling social media campaign that the Internet Research Agency has undertaken. So there were it was a multi-pronged approach, if you will. And so and behind some of these efforts, including somebody like Maria Butina, somebody who was also indicted recently as an agent of the Russian government, behind all of these efforts, there's money. You know, sometimes it's connected to specific oligarchs that maybe are vying for a spot in Putin's inner circle, and so it's a very complex system. But what's evident is this was a very multifaceted sort of operation, and I think the special counsel investigation is sort of unearthing all the different elements of it.
And in the broader sense, Deanna, at least it's my belief that what's going on here is that basically you're dealing with Putin, who's kind of a gangster. And we've never had this situation in geopolitics, the combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia, and nuclear weapons. So it's a very different situation altogether. But obviously, nuclear weapons are irrelevant in a sense because nobody wants to use them. So when Putin was sanctioned for annexing Crimea and starting a war with Ukraine, what choices did he have? Not much. But the one choice that I think he chose is to use this form of hybrid warfare that he has perfected. He's perfected it in earlier attacks on the Baltic states, for example. And a part of hybrid warfare is this way to screw with the Americans beneath the threshold of what they call kinetic warfare. So this is the way I see it. As long as we're sanctioning him, and by the way, today the State Department just added sanctions against Russia because of the use of Novichok nerve agent in the UK. So as long as we're sanctioning Putin, he's going to screw with us. Isn't that logical?
Well, in one sense, that would be counterproductive. The more sanctions we impose, the sort of more troubles he caused. So I don't know that I would say that, but we have to. And you're right. He's sort of engaged in recent years. He's engaged in this hybrid, almost asymmetric warfare. And through exploitations of divisions that exist in the West, that exist here in the United States, and they've been pretty effective tools, I would say, and they're are continuing to use them. I think we've had recent reporting that issues with social media continue to this day and are threatening the November elections. There's various means of using cyber warfare to also undermine infrastructure and other important sort of functions. So it's not clear what the best sort of, at least to me, I'm not a statesman or right. In terms of what the best approach is to deal with Putin. But I think when the West hasn't reacted very strongly to his annexation of Crimea and the meddling that he's done in Ukraine, I think that emboldened him, to be sure. And kind of a useful book, perhaps I would recommend to your listeners, is called The Road to Unfreedom by Timothy Snyder, a Yale professor. And he kind of goes back and unpacks some of the tactics Putin has used in the West and here in the United States after the Crimea annexation. And certainly asymmetric warfare is something that he's very reliant on.
Well, you mentioned the November elections. To my mind, it's not inconceivable that Vladimir Putin will sabotage the elections. It's a part of the same playbook that he's used in 2016, and he didn't necessarily think Trump was going to win. like most people, he thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, but he had his bases covered because it had Hillary Clinton won, Donald Trump would be going around this country holding rallies saying, lock her up, lock her up, and that would continue to divide America, and that is what Putin's tactic is. And we, of course, help him a lot because we are divided and we are balkanized in terms of our thinking and our politics, etc. So my sense is that he will screw with the 2018 election and that the Democratic blue wave may be taken away through cyber meddling. And then there'll be enormous repercussions and tremendous dislocation and enormous anger. And, of course, Trump is not going to – he's going to lose the House probably. And if he – if suddenly the Republicans miraculously maintain control of the House, there'd be all hell to pay. So I know it sounds a little far-fetched to a lot of our listeners, but I don't think it's that far-fetched. I think it's perhaps even almost inevitable.
Yes, there's great concern that this interference will continue on through the November elections and perhaps in 2020 as well. And our hope is that the experience of the past elections will inspire legislators to really safeguard our elections. And there have already been bills and legislation introduced on election security, and this is a matter of great importance. And hopefully this experience, the investigation, will help galvanize not only the public but also our elected officials to take this threat more seriously.
Well, just in closing, today we had the charges of insider trading against Congressman Chris Collins, a Republican of New York, who was the first congressman to endorse Donald Trump. We also learned from Forbes magazine that the Secretary of Treasury, Wilbur Ross, stole $230 million from a business partner and had to quietly settle that before he became Commerce Secretary. So how much are we becoming the kind of kleptocracy under Donald Trump that Putin has perfected in Russia?
It is becoming increasingly a concern. This administration has seen unprecedented issues of corruption. Everyone in many in Trump's orbit are confronting it. Just the other day, Wall Street Journal, for instance, reported that Michael Cohen, too, may be facing charges of bank fraud, tax evasion in New York. And this is, of course, the same Michael Cohen who allegedly offered access to Trump to different companies, even one connected to Russia and a Russian oligarch. So this issue of self-dealing, corruption, it's certainly a theme of this administration. And unfortunately, there are echoes of political systems in places like Eastern Europe, and it's something that we should be very much aware of and something we should recognize and not normalize. Corruption, you know, institutions are not infallible, and corruption can become normalized. It seems each new low is sort of absorbed and we move on, and I think we shouldn't. It's an important issue that I think Democrats are doing a good job of highlighting in the coming elections, and certainly looking at some of these other systems like Ukraine should prove a warning to how things can erode and democratic institutions can erode and not recover easily.
Well, Diana Pilipenko, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Diana Pilipenko, who is the Associate Director for Anti-Corruption and Illicit Finance at the Center for American Progress, who previously managed corporate investigations and analysis at Deloitte, a Big Four accounting firm specializing in anti-corruption, anti-money laundering, sanctions, and export controls compliance. She led numerous investigations and assessments on behalf of commercial, federal, and nonprofit organizations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with an expert on Turkey about how Vice President Pence's ties to the evangelical community has made the release of an American fundamentalist pastor a top priority.
Back in the U.S.S.R. Well, the jury girls really knocked me out. Leave the West behind. And move on, girls, make me sing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He has organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thanks. Happy to be with you, Ian.
And it looks as though the United States and Turkey are on a collision course. How much is it to do with the personalities of the two leaders? Erdogan is a sort of boneheaded autocrat, and we have a kind of empty-headed autocrat, if you will. Do you see that as a problem here or a part of the mix?
It's definitely part of the mix, and it's what's prompted this, you know, sort of spectacular public spat. The tensions between the U.S. and Turkey, of course, date back much longer to really 2013 is where they kicked off. Of course, there have always been issues. Turkey didn't allow U.S. troops access through Turkey during the invasion of Iraq back in 2003, which was a major crisis, and there have been previous crises. But really, beginning in 2013, what happened was Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan began moving in a quite authoritarian direction. The Gezi Park protests were sort of the famous example of this, plastered across Western media outlets, and he cracked down on that, which led President Obama to really sort of change his thinking on Turkey and Erdogan, move him from a partner with whom he thought he shared a relationship and values to someone he just had to deal with on issues like Syria. Then, beginning in 2014, U.S. and Turkish policy on Syria began to diverge pretty dramatically, particularly over the U.S. relationship with the Kurdish militias in Syria. And then, you know, that sort of tension bubbled away in the background, but was managed at the government-to-government level. And then in July 2016, there was a coup attempt in Turkey and the ensuing sweeping crackdown on dissent, which further torpedoed relations. Turkey harbored suspicions that the U.S. was somehow involved in it. And, of course, the U.S. did not approve of Turkey's, you know, dramatic authoritarian crackdown. And so those are sort of the long-running issues, along with Turkey's, cozier relations with Russia in the last 3 years, really. But unquestionably, the personalities of these two leaders have contributed to today's crisis. And really, the question moving forward is whether the crisis over these American citizens who are being detained in Turkey and all of the other bilateral issues will be managed by the foreign ministry and the State Department, respectively, at the professional level, or whether the presidents will stay involved with all of the ego and sort of brashness that brings along with it.
Well, on August the 2nd, the United States slapped sanctions on Turkish Justice Minister and its Interior Minister, but nothing has essentially happened since over a year ago. Erdogan jailed two employees of the State Department. These are Turkish nationals working in the U.S. embassies. And all around the world, U.S. embassies depend upon local employees. This is something that's been going on for decades, if not centuries. And the State Department didn't do a damn thing, not a word, to come to the rescue of these people who are jailed on trumped-up charges. And most of the focus has been on this evangelical minister, Andrew Brunson of North Carolina, a fundamentalist pastor who's been imprisoned in Turkey since October 2016. And it was only because Mike Pence, Vice President Pence, because of his evangelical bent, brought this up. And most of the focus is on getting Brunson out, but not on dealing with the imprisoned Turkish employees, former employees of the State Department.
It's a difficult situation. The State Department has, been pressing Turkey privately for since their arrest on the subject of the Foreign Service nationals that you mentioned, as well as U.S. citizens beyond Andrew Brunson who are being detained. But certainly the domestic political side has led, as well as the, legitimate advocacy of Christian groups and on human rights activists on Brunson's account have really caused him to become the cause célèbre, if you will. I mean, the fact is the U.S. government privately had conveyed to to Turkey that all of these people need to be released or there are going to be consequences. But the Turks really realized that because of the political interest in Andrew Brunson, as you mentioned, driven in large part by Vice President Pence and sort of his evangelical base, that they could use Brunson, or so they thought, to really earn concessions from the United States on other bilateral issues. You know, and there are a whole host of them, are U.S. policy in Syria, the, you know, matter of, well, several arms sales, both between the U.S. and Turkey and between Turkey and Russia, also sanctions the U.S. is, you know, likely preparing on Turkish state Halk Bank for Iran sanctions evasion. You know, there are a whole host of issues, and Turkey said, they, you know, the U.S. really want this guy out. Let's throw him into the bargain and try and get some concessions for him. That strategy has really spectacularly backfired, and the reason for that is you know, President Trump waded into this issue in dramatic fashion. He, at the sideline of the NATO summit, thought he had struck a deal with President Erdogan in which Trump would get Bibi Netanyahu in Israel to release a Turkish woman who was imprisoned there, and in exchange, Erdogan would release Brunson, or so Trump thought. There, clearly, he didn't convey the message directly enough, because the Turks either reneged on the deal or misunderstood the terms and only released Brunson to house arrest in Turkey and didn't release him back to the U.S. And President Trump lost his temper and ordered these sanctions you mentioned last week, and really we're off to the races now, because both sides have domestic political constituencies that are pressuring them not to back down. Both leaders, as you mentioned at the start, are, you know, very strong egos that are not used to backing down or making concessions. And it's come in the context of years of mistrust between the U.S. and Turkey on a whole range of issues. So, you know, there's every chance that things continue to escalate. The U.S. could, for example, you know, lob the Halk Bank fine for Iran sanctions evasion Turkey's way. Turkey could do any number of things to retaliate. But right now, Turkish officials are at the State Department trying to de-escalate. And the reason for that is Turkey's economy is very vulnerable, and the U.S., the threat of further U.S. sanctions is doing tremendous damage to the lira. So it's a crucial relationship. Neither side can really afford to let it go completely into the tank. But the politics in both countries is interfering at the moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish region's U.S. defense budgeting and policy and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. He has organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. Well, the lira has just gone down, what, about 30% just a couple of days. Monday, it dropped to 5.42 against the dollar. And that has to be getting the attention of the Turkish business community. Most of them, or a lot of them, have joined in the kind of kleptocracy that Erdogan and his family run. But I assume there are some more independent businessmen who must be concerned about the broader economy and the future of Turkey. Is there a split in the business community that might cause? I don't know how you stop this guy. I mean, he's had these referendums, that have been largely questioned. He seems to have gradually accrued more and more power. So that's the big question that hovers over everything. And what can be done to stop this guy? And could the Turkish business community be a beginning?
Well, the business community is very nervous, and has been for over a year now. The Turkish economy has been in this slow motion sort of lurch to a crisis for over a year. Inflation is above 15%. Youth unemployment is above 20%. The official unemployment rate is hovered around 15%, but is likely higher. 12%, but is likely higher. And Turkey has this very persistent current accounts deficit where they need a large amount of outside financing to keep the economy turning over. Erdogan has really exacerbated the economic crisis by, as you said, consolidating power in his hands personally. He's undermined the independence of the central bank, which means that investors have no confidence that the central bank will raise interest rates if necessary to protect the currency and curb inflation. And so And, you know, further, businessmen and women don't have any confidence that the Turkish courts or judicial system will deliver fair verdicts. So, you know, private property rights are somewhat in question as well, which has further undermined business confidence. So the business community is terrified. And, you know, they look at the prospect of further U.S. sanctions over what in their view is sort of a silly political, sort of spat as just the icing on this very, very troubling cake. But as you said, Erdogan has now been in power for more than 15 years. He's gone from strength to strength electorally, and there's no meaningful challenge to his political control. And he has really co-opted most of the business community and built this strong and widespread patronage system in which, you know, big public contracts are handed out to cronies, and cronies in turn buy media outlets and ensure favorable coverage, and everybody sort of gets along. So, you know, he's got to be concerned about the continuing economic crisis. That's generally how Turkish governments fall, is that the economy crashes and then finally voters turn on them. It hasn't happened yet. But the other side of this is that Erdogan has built sort of his right-wing constituency on this nationalism and this sort of threat of outside conspiracy that he puts forward, which means he can twist the U.S. sanctions as a conspiracy to sort of bring Turkey down and try and rally nationalist votes to his side in the local elections next year. But we'll see. You know, at some point, the cost of basic goods keep going up, and ordinary Turks are going to take notice.
Well, in many ways, it would seem to me that both Trump and Erdogan have similar political support in terms of, you know, a red state, blue state divide, if you will, with Trump not being popular in large cities and particularly on the coasts, California and New York and the Northeast, but popular in rural parts where you have a strong Christian evangelical support for Trump in spite of his personal predilections. And it seems to me that that's pretty similar, isn't it? That the educated urban Turks can't stand Erdogan, whereas the rural people are caught up in his sort of Islamist version of, what do they call, what's the party called? The Party of Development and Progress or something?
Oh, the Justice and Development Party.
Yeah.
You're right, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating comparison, and it's not just Turkey and the United States. We see this dynamic playing out in a number of countries, including, you know, Poland and Hungary, where clearly something has happened where these global cities, these coastal elites feel, you know, comfortable in and see the opportunities coming from globalization, from cosmopolitan, you know, lifestyles, from interactions with other countries. And then there's this reactionary, this response to that has certainly grown in strength over the last few years. In Turkey, it's been building for some time. And, it's a really good comparison you make, because in some ways there are similar stories here. Erdogan says, you know, there are international conspiracies to hold Turkey back, to harm its economy, because they fear our strength. They don't want us to be, you know, more independent. Trump will talk about how the U.S. is constantly getting a raw deal, how its allies are taking advantage of it, how, you know, the international system hasn't done anything for the U.S. So yeah, there are some similarities. And so it's kind of ironic, you know, early in Trump's term, he spoke of Erdogan and some of his strongman tendencies in glowing terms. So it's a real change to see these two, one autocrat and maybe one wannabe autocrat, kind of at each other's throats politically. We'll see if it lasts.
So what's the situation vis-a-vis NATO, since Turkey is a NATO member, and there have been threats, and of course Erdogan controls the press there. So when all that anti-Americanism in the press is being orchestrated by him, and there's lots of talk about kicking the Americans out of the NATO base Incirlik, which is critical to the U.S. military mission in Syria. So where does that stand? Do you think at the end of the day, Erdogan, if he has to choose between Russia and America or Russia and NATO, I can't see him choosing Russia, because in spite of cozying up to Putin, isn't there just, you know, centuries of enmity between those two countries?
There is, you know, a history. I think they've fought 16 or 17 wars in their history. But in the last 3 years, they've rapidly built a very close working relationship. And I think what's happening here is Erdogan sort of wants it both ways. He and his inner circle think that the world is multipolar, that the U.S. is a fading power, that Turkey should be sort of more independent and a strong power in its own right, that Turkey should be able to, you know, be a NATO ally, but also have these very cozy relations with Russia. And they don't see a tension there. The U.S. looks at Turkey, for example, you know, saying they're going to buy Russian S-400s, this air defense system, or giving Russian companies the, you know, contracts to build nuclear power plants in Turkey, and say, hang on, you can't be a NATO ally and enjoy all of the benefits of that, whether it's defense, you know, it's protection and technology and prestige. You can't be a NATO ally and also have these very close relations with Russia. That's not how it works. This alliance is really aimed at containing Russian aggression. And the Turks are chafing at the U.S.'s efforts to sort of make them choose. I think you're right. I think that most sober Turkish policymakers know that Turkey's interests are better served by close relations with the West and with NATO than with Russia, because, you know, Turkey has to buy energy from Russia. They have, you know, extensive pipeline ties. They buy much of their energy from Russia. They have to sort of keep that relationship on an even keel to some extent, but most of their economy is driven by European and Western investment, and they have to understand that that's the more important relationship. But, you know, we are seeing this, we've seen this slow drift of Turkey from NATO. The alliance itself continues to try and play down tensions and sort of talk about Turkey's value, talk about NATO's value to Turkey. But at some point, you can't insulate those sort of military ties, strategic ties, from the politics on both sides, but particularly in Turkey, where this right-wing authoritarianism, this nationalism that views the international community as a sort of a threat, you can't insulate things forever. So we may be at, you know, a real turning point. We'll see. And the key, I think, is whether, as I said at the beginning, the kind of foreign policy professionals in both governments can take control of these issues and manage them slowly and soberly, or whether the two presidents, you know, remain the driving force for policy on both sides, in which case things could really get out of hand.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, the Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, who focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. And he's organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.